Two Kingdoms, number 66, Descent into the Abyss, maybe. Okay, well, we're in 1681, so for those of you who are visiting, put you in the right year. Last week we covered the battle at Erdmas, where Richard Cameron was killed and David Haxton of Rathlet was captured. We covered the torture and execution of David Haxton in more detail than some of our squeamish listeners might have preferred. We covered the Torwood excommunication, where Donald Cargill pronounced a sentence of excommunication on Charles II. His brother, not Cargill's brother, Charles's brother, James, the Duke of York, later to be James II. The Duke of Lauderdale, the Duke of Monmouth, the Earl of Ross, and others, a couple other state officers. The excommunication was not, I would say it was not laughed off as the harmless ramblings of a fanatic. It was partly laughed off as the ramblings of a fanatic, but it certainly wasn't considered to be harmless. Rather, they set a higher price on Cargill's head. Cargill himself was captured in July of 1681. And when brought to Edinburgh, he had this famous encounter with the Earl of Rose, who threatened him, and Cargill said, you know, don't bother threatening me, because whatever death I die, you're going to die first. Not in those exact words. And the Earl of Rose did indeed die, I think the night before that Cargill was executed, and he died in misery, moaning that Cargill's sentence would indeed be binding on him to eternity. Okay, I ended last week what was intended to be a final anecdote on Cargill. Yes, we will get more than heaven. We will get God glorified on earth, which is more than heaven. But afterwards, there was one question raised about the Covenanter view of martyrdom. I read this quote by Richard Cameron, where he said, right at Erdmas, he says, "Be encouraged, all of you, to fight it out valiantly, for all of you that shall fall this day, I see heaven's gates cast wide open to receive them." And you might get the impression this sounds something like this Islamic martyrdom. And, you know, the idea being, oh, you're going to be a martyr and then you're going to go to heaven. And I don't think that's what Cameron was saying, but it did sound a little bit like this. But I thought to look a little more at the Covenanter view of martyrdom, it would be worthwhile reading a little bit from Cargill's letter written to two men captured at Erdmas, John Malcolm and Archibald Allison. They were, of course, sentenced to death. And this is from Maurice Grant's book, No King But Christ, the biography of Donald Cargill. And he quotes this letter, "Dear friends, death in Christ and for Christ is never much to be bemoaned, and less at this time than any other, when these that survive have nothing to live among but miseries, persecution, snares, sorrows, and sinning, where the only desirable sight, Christ reigning in a free and flourishing church, is wanting. And the greatly grieving and offensive object to devout souls, devils and the worst of the wicked reigning and raging, is still before our eyes. And though we had greater things to leave and better times to live in, yet eternity does so far exceed and excel these things in their greatest perfection, that they who see and are sure, and we see indeed being made sure, will never let a tear fall or a sigh go at the farewell." Okay, now this is the important part here. "Neither let the goodness of the cause you suffer for found your confidence in God and your hope of well-being. For were the action never so good, and performed without the least failing, it could never be a cause of obtaining mercy, nor yet commend us to that grace from which we are to obtain it. There is nothing now which is yours, when you are pleading and petitioning for mercy, that must be remembered, but your sins, for in effect there is nothing else ours. Let your sins then be on your hearts as your sorrow, and let these mercies of God and merits of Christ be before your eyes as your hopes. And your winning to these is the only rock upon which we can be saved. If there be anything seen or looked to in ourselves but sin, we cannot expect remission and salvation solely through free grace, in which expectation only can be obtained. Look well then to your faith, that it be a faith growing out of regeneration in the new creature, and that have Christ for its righteousness, hope and rejoicing, and be sealed by the Spirit of God." Okay, letter goes on in more or less the same vein, but I think that probably conveys. I mean, it was not, you know, be a martyr and you'll go to heaven. So, and he makes, I think Cargill makes that pretty clear, that no matter how great a action they're, you know, they had been involved in, it's completely unworthy. So, okay, the let's see. Okay, so we pick up the day following the execution of Cargill, the 28th of July, 1681. The Scottish Parliament met. James, the Duke of York, again, brother of Charles, was Charles's commissioner to Parliament. As you, I think I mentioned this before, he was on partly a mission to sort of get everything under control in Scotland. And partly for his eventual succession to the throne. So he, and he replaced the Duke of Lauderdale, who had by this time getting pretty old and close to his death. He died in 1682. And he'd been used and pushed aside, and it's interesting, he'd served Charles all this time, and you know, with apparently no thanks whatsoever. His death was not mourned. Okay. Now, I said part of his visit was to get things under control. The first act of the Parliament, quote, secured the Protestant religion and renewed the ban against popery. Interesting, because James is a Catholic. The second act, passed the same day, asserted the right of succession to the crown and declared that kings of Scotland derive their power from God alone and succeed each other lineally, so that, quote, no difference in religion, nor no law, nor act Parliament made or to be made, can alter or divert the right of succession and lineal descent of the crown to the nearest and lawful heirs. Specified as treason any endeavor by word or act to dispute or alter these facts. And as Hewison says, this was a new blossom on the tree planted by King James. The time-honored political dogmas of the Knox Buchanan school, which the Covenants rested, were taboo, or in fact were treason. So, anyways, so when James returned to England, he had his right to succeed Charles on the Scottish throne was assured. Although in the event he never actually was crowned in Scotland. So the Parliament then passed an act anent religion and the test. It required everyone except the king and his brothers with any position of public trust in the kingdom to take an oath known as the test. Defined who was a holder of public trust very broadly. Included, of course, all members of Parliament, privy councillors, judges, bureaucrats, and quoting from the Test Act, all collectors, sub-collectors, and farmers of His Majesty's custom and excise. Archbishops, bishops, ministers, etc. But it also went down as far as chaplains and families, which was a position sometimes held by some otherwise covenanter ministers who, of course, couldn't have another position at the time. School teachers and soldiers. Anyone who presumed to take such an office without taking the test oath would be punished with the loss of their movables and life rent escheat, the one half whereof to be given to the informer and the other half to belong to His Majesty. Okay, and as I think we've discussed before, quite a bit of the persecution had its root just pure greed. The fact that we can find all these people with religious convictions, and you can see this, if you inform on them, you could get half their movables and their life rent. So, pretty good deal, I guess, as it were, or seemingly a good deal. Let's see, I was going to read this, but then I think, in the event I didn't actually bring the book that had it in it, let's see, Hewison gave a highly condensed form, so we'll get that. Okay, he's there's lots and lots of ellipses here, but I swear I sincerely profess the true Protestant religion contained in the Confession of Faith recorded in the first Parliament of King James VI. Shall adhere thereto, educate my children therein, never consent to any change thereto, renounce all such principles inconsistent with the said religion and confession. So far, so good. Right. Affirm the king's majesty as the only supreme governor in all causes ecclesiastical as well as civil. Renounce all foreign jurisdictions. Judge it unlawful to enter into covenants or to assemble in assemblies, to treat in any manner of state without his majesty's special command, or to take up arms against the king. That there lies no obligation on me from the national covenant or the solemn league and covenant or any other, to endeavor any change or alteration in the government either in church or state. Shall maintain and never decline his majesty's power and jurisdiction. Swear that this is my oath, never without any swear that this is my oath without any equivocation, mental reservation, or any manner of evasion whatsoever. At least one contemporary covenanter commentator said that the oath was absurd, that it implied one was a Presbyterian, an Episcopalian, and a Catholic all at once. And though you might think that the government's policies to date would have disenfranchised anyone with half a conscience, the Test Act was unpopular with even the bishops and Episcopal clergy, not to mention, I suppose, the indulged clergy. For the indulged ministers, it must have been a bitter pill to swallow. All right, their compromise in accepting a position in the church with the attached terms would now be very, made very clear how much compromise there was. According to Hewison, many honest Orthodox clergy preferred deprivation to compliance. I know there are 20 Episcopal ministers even who left the church when it went to England. A number of the nobility and so on actually refused to take the test. Not huge numbers, but some. The Earl of Argyll would only take the test so far as it is consistent with itself or the Protestant religion. Okay, that wasn't good enough. Somebody I was reading said actually that most of the Episcopal, the bishops and so on, hadn't actually read the National Covenant. So I don't know if he really knows or not. The Earl of Argyll's explanation wasn't good enough, so he was removed from public office and he was prosecuted for treason. He was convicted and had his estates confiscated. This was the second time in two generations. However, you'll like this, he was able to escape from the castle of Edinburgh disguised as the page of his stepdaughter. So, where later, then he went to the continent and he got involved in this plot to overthrow the king, which I'm going to skip over, but it involved the Duke of Monmouth and so on. They were planning on overthrowing Charles. It was not, the Covenanters stayed out of this plot because they didn't, it wasn't going to reestablish the covenants, it was just to overthrow the king. Okay. Well, after the death of Cargill, the remnants of the Presbyterians were really without any ministers or public leadership. And about this time, they started to form themselves into societies. There's relatively little information available, at least to me, about the societies. Hewison has a short description. Incidentally, these societies are really our direct forerunners of our own denomination. The people came here from Scotland and started the church here, where it had come out of the societies, which actually, we're talking about them before the Glorious Revolution, but they stayed intact. A lot of the people would not rejoin the established church afterwards. So, let's see. Hewison quotes, this is actually a letter from J.B. Dalzell, who says, "The peculiar dangers to which the Covenanters were exposed from 1660 to the Revolution demanded the adoption of certain precautions if they were to retain their lives and freedom. Accordingly, it was agreed among themselves that no public action was to be taken by any individual independently of the general body, and it followed as a natural consequence that if a common understanding were to be maintained amongst them, a permanent union of some sort would require to be inaugurated. That union eventually took the shape of the United Societies, and delegates from each district of societies met quarterly for consultation and united action. The various grades of organization of the members of the United Societies were general meetings held quarterly, shire meetings or correspondences, societies, and lastly, fellowship meetings. The results and productions of the general meetings were various declarations, the renewing of the covenants, the printing of the cloud of witnesses and other volumes, the placing of memorial stones over the graves of the martyrs, the guarding of the convention, the raising of the Cameronian regiment in 1689 at Douglas, and many others that have exercised a more or less perceptible influence over the destinies of the country. Okay, so that's a very brief description. Alexander Smellie, in his book Men of the Covenant, has a brief description of a society meeting. There is a book by the brother of Alexander Shields, Michael Shields, that covers some of this. It's not readily available even as a rare bound photocopy or in the the Wing collection at the university. I guess it apparently didn't go into print until the 1700s. So with Michael Shields for our guide, we have the opportunity of entering a society meeting. There may be 30 or 70 persons present, or maybe 60 or 70 persons present. They have assembled probably under cover of the night, and there is a friendly farmhouse close at hand. Everything is done in quietness and order. A president is chosen, and by and by he states a special question to be discussed. Perhaps it is, must we decline to pay bridge dues and market dues, as well as assess and militia money? Some insist on the extremer position, but they are overruled by the larger number, who are not prepared to go so far in non-compliance. Or it may be, how shall we help our brothers who are reduced to poverty by their refusal to submit to the tyrannous demands of government? Then those who have not been fined and stripped to the same sad extent promise their aid, for the society men have learned to bear one another's burdens and so to fulfill the law of Christ. Or it is, if there should be a popish rising, must we refrain from assisting our country in the moment of its dire distress? And the decision is a patriotic one. There must not be any intimate association with royalists, but the Cameronians may organize by themselves with their fighting forces and may strike hard against Jesuitry and all its works. Ere many years have passed, they will be actually be doing it to good purpose. Right, in the Jacobite uprisings, Cameronians fought. Often in the general meeting, the talk would turn on the crying need for ministers of the gospel, who should preserve their garments unspotted and their witness unshaken and full. And it was agreed that the only method of obtaining these was to send some of their own young men to Holland to be educated and ordained by the exiled covenanters there. But in the midst of those anxious colloquies over the practical difficulties of the time, the societies never forgot the perpetual claims of the individual soul. Their meetings were homes of earnest prayer and patient study of the scriptures, and the worshippers who went to them would come away with their faces transfigured and their spirits empowered with new and heavenly strength. That's about all the information I've been able to find, although this is interesting because the things they were debating, you'll see when Rennick comes to... Rennick goes out of the societies to Holland to get some theological training, gets ordained there, comes back, and some of the people wouldn't own him because he'd been ordained by this corrupt church, or in Holland, or the very things he's talking about here actually are there. come out a little bit later. Let's see. Okay, their first general meeting was held at Les Mahago, which is about 20 miles southeast of Glasgow, right off the M74 today, on the 15th of December, 1681. They decided to have four meetings a year, and so that was the quarterly general meetings, and as what we read said, nothing was to be done in matters concerning the whole body without the knowledge and consent of the general meeting. Right? And this provision was aimed at guarding against those who had more zeal than knowledge. Although, as Hewison said, they'd already thrown off their allegiance to the king and now resolved to make it known that they would not submit tamely to being butchered. But even amongst them, there were some people who were really extremists. So... they decided to make a public declaration at Lanark, on the 12th of January, 1682, Rennick and about 60 other covenanters gathered at the cross of Lanark, which, according to Hewison, they defaced with four hammers. I presume that's like sledgehammers. Burned the obnoxious statutes and decrees and affixed the declaration at noon. The declaration itself had been written at the 15th of December meeting, and I was planning on reading part of it. It's about four pages altogether. We'll skip over quite a bit of it. But the introduction says, although we ought to take in good part whatever God in his infinite wisdom hath for the punishment of our sin, carved out unto us, and I acknowledge him alone in it, and though we always ought to acknowledge government and governors as ordained by him, insofar as they rule and govern according to the rules set down by him in his word, and the constitutional laws of the nation, and ought to cast the mantle of love on the lesser errors of governors, and give the best countenance to their administration that the nature of their actions will bear. Yet when all these laws, both of God and the kingdom, conditional and constitutive of the government, are cast and annulled by pretended laws and the highest of usurpation and an inexplicable prerogative in matters ecclesiastic, an arbitrary government in matters civils is arrogate. When a banner of impiety, profaneness, and atheism is avowedly displayed against the heavens, a door open of all sorts and sizes, and the remedy thereof still denied by him who should be as a sun and shield of the people. When the parliaments, who ought to be the grand trustees of the kingdom, to whom it belongs in such a case to secure the civil and spiritual interests, are so prelimited by law that no true son of the state or church hath liberty to sit and vote there, so that the parliaments in all places of public trust and offices of the kingdom, from the highest to lowest, are made up of none but those who are corrupted, overawed, overruled, and bribed. What shall the people do in such an extremity? So Francis Schaeffer wasn't the first one to think of a title like that. Should they give their reason as men, their consciences as Christians, and resign their liberties, fortunes, religion, and all to the inexorable obstinacy, incurable willfulness, and malice of these, who in spite of God and man, and notwithstanding of their many oaths and vows both to God and his people, are resolved to make their own will the absolute sovereign rule of their actions, and their strained indulgences, and the measures of the subject's hope and happiness? Shall the end of government be lost through weakness, wickedness, and tyranny of governors? Must the people, by an implicit submission and deplorable stupidity, destroy themselves and betray their posterity and become objects of reproach to the present generation and pity and contempt to the future? Have they not, in such an extremity, good ground to make use of that natural radical power they have, to shake off that yoke which neither we nor our forefathers were able to bear? Which accordingly the Lord honored us in a general and unprelimited meeting of the states and shires of Scotland to do, a convention of unprelimited members, a convention of men who had only the glory of God and the good of the Commonwealth before their eyes, the like whereof the present reigning tyrant could never, since his homecoming, pretend to. At which convention he was most legally and by general consent cast off, by the declaration afterwards published at Sancor by a special warrant from the said convention. But that we may not seem to have done that, or yet to do the like upon no grounds, or yet upon few and small grounds, we shall hint at some of the many thousands of misdemeanors of the now cast off tyrant and his overturning of our church and state. Okay, so they then go on several pages of Charles's crimes, which you're all aware of, so we won't reread. So, is it then any wonder, considering such dealings and many thousands more, that true Scotsmen, though we've always been, and even to extremity, sometimes loyal to our kings, should after 20 years' tyranny break out at last, as we have done, and put in practice that power which God and nature hath given us, and we have reserved to ourselves, as our engagements with our princes have always been conditional, as other kingdoms are implicitly, but ours explicitly? Let none therefore object against the legality of what we have done, or are doing, for we offer as how inconsiderable we are said to be, to prove ourselves to have done nothing against our ancient laws, civil or ecclesiastic, against any lawyers or divines whatsoever, our ancient laws being judges, and we having safety to pass and repass that the public faith after so many breaches can be trusted for that effect. So then let no foreign kingdoms or churches through misinformation or false copies, as they are many, of what we act or do, because we have no access to the press as they, we say let them not take up a wrong opinion of us or our proceedings, for we are only endeavoring to extricate ourselves from under a tyrannous yoke, and to reduce our church and state to what they were in the years 1648 and 1649. Okay, so then they go on to say that they ratify and approve the Rutherglen and Sancor declarations, and do by these present rescind, annul, and make void whatsoever hath been done by Charles Stuart or his accomplices in prejudice to our ancient laws and liberties in all the several pretended and pre-limited parliaments and conventions since the year 1660, and particularly the late Parliament holden at Edinburgh the 28th of July 1681 by a commissioner professedly popish, right, James, and for villainy exiled his native land with all the acts and laws there statute and enacted, as that abominable, ridiculous, unparalleled and soul perjuring test and the rest. So there's a little bit more, but that's the gist of the Lanark declaration. Well, in the years following Cargill's execution, the persecution continued to get worse. You'll hear sometimes this term, the killing times, and different people will attach different meanings to it. It's said either to start about the end of today's class, 1684, or the next year, somewhere in there. The last three or four years are what generally called the killing times. But it's sort of a slide into the abyss, as it were. Claverhouse and others marched to and fro in southwest Scotland primarily, doing all manners of evil. And to give a systematic account would be somewhat difficult, but what I'll attempt to do is give you somewhat of an anecdotal account. At the blunt end, gross malfeasance of justice was common. Hewison says that various petitions prove that many men, women, mothers with babes, and youths lay for long periods without being charged, some dying of neglect and others from the foulness of the dungeons. Fountainhall mentions that Mary and Purdy died of cold and poverty at Christmas because the Lord Advocate had no time to indict her for witchcraft. Yet, interestingly, while the prisons overflowed with Covenanters, they vacated charges against murderers and thieves. But of course, charging murderers and thieves wasn't near as financially rewarding as charging landed gentry who might have some sympathy to the Covenanters. There are a number of cases of children being mistreated, or we would say abused in 21st century language. One is the case of the Nisbet children, two sons, ages 10 and 14. John Nisbet had fought at Drumclog, probably at Bothwell too, but... Well, in fact, Nisbet was a sergeant. He was somebody who really had military training and had been in the Continental Wars earlier. In order to find them, he was trying to find where... The soldiers took the younger son. They were trying to find where the fugitive Covenanters were hiding. They terrified him with drawn swords and fired pistols, blindfolded him, set him up to be shot, beat him with swords, fists and feet, kicked him several times to the ground, called the speechless child vile, ugly, dumb devil, and beat him down and left him in his blood. That's a 10-year-old. Let's see. There's a couple similar atrocities recorded... a 15-year-old resident at West Arnbuckles, examined by Archibald Inglis and officers whose men beat the boy till he bled and dragged him by the hair to a fire where they held him till his eyes were like to jump out of their sockets, wrung his nose till it bled, beat him amid curses and insensibility. Another 16-year-old, William Hanna from Dumfrieshire, was ague-struck. He had malaria. Was taken, trailed along by soldiery, threatened with execution, sent to Edinburgh, thumbscrewed there, robbed, and sold into Barbados, whence he returned to become minister in Scarborough. And then Patrick Walker, who was survived the killing times and wrote, I think, a number of small books, but one of them was called Six Saints of the Covenant. Hewison says, Patrick Walker, to whom we are indebted for many strange reminiscences of an evil time, took pride narrating the share he had as a youth of 16 in the dispatch by a pocket pistol of a lecherous ruffian of Meldrum and Airlie's command named Francis Gordon. On the morning of the 2nd March, this debauchee, unable to sleep, ran amok with drawn sword, threatening to send to hell three fugitives whom he started at Mossplat near Lanark. In the fray, Gordon fell dead with a shot in the head. In his pocket, Patrick found a list of suspects, which he tore in pieces, and some Popish books and money, which he replaced. And he goes on to say, Patrick said that he wished all the blood of the Lord's enemies had so gone out with a gush. So, sometimes the children fought back. Robbery was common. It was common for the soldiers to steal everything edible and movable. Claverhouse himself, in a report to the Privy Council, claimed to reduce Galloway to obedience without blood, without severity or extortion. Yet in the same report he claims that he rifled so their houses, ruined their goods, that their wives and children were brought to starving, few heritors being fined, and that but gently. Oh, to be gently persecuted by Claverhouse. You can't always take him too seriously. He was once, when he was on the Privy Council, they were querying somebody, a landowner in Galloway or Dumfriesshire, who said basically that the people had more or less been restored to regular behavior. And Claverhouse said there were as many elephants and crocodiles in Galloway as there were people with regular behavior. We have the first accounts, though. I mean, one thing about Claverhouse is, I think one of the reasons he has such a bad reputation is that he personally did a lot of persecution himself, not just by ordering his men around. One Thomas Gregg, merchant Carrick, who also survived, informed Wadrow that while he was traveling with his pack, he was seized on the public road by Claverhouse, robbed of his goods and money, brought through New Galloway to Dumfries on a barebacked horse, kept without food or drink, and in a famishing condition thrown into Dumfries jail along with other prisoners captured at this time and kept there 11 days. The food brought to them by sympathizers was dashed out of their hands and tramped on by the soldiers. Without trial, Gregg was removed to Leith, put on a ship going to Holland, being given away as a recruit. That was April 4, 1682. This was also supposed to have happened in 1682, although I guess there is some question about the date, but John Graham of Claverhouse, Viscount of Dundee, in the year 1682, with a party of his troop, pursued William Graham in Galloway, making his escape from his mother's house, and overtaking him instantly, shot him dead. Defoe, this is Daniel Defoe of Robinson Crusoe, who declares that he talked with many sober and judicious persons who lived in that part of the country at the time and were eyewitnesses to much of it, is specific in numbering Graham among those whom Claverhouse barbarously murdered with his own hands. He designates him one of his own name, namely Graham of Galloway, evidently trusting to the memorial but adding these details. Claverhouse rode after him and overtook him, and although the young man offered to surrender and begged him to save his life, he shot him dead with his pistol. Two more pathetic examples are James Gray and Robert Nairn. James Gray, father of the youth who fell so gallantly fighting at Ayresmoss, illustrates the persistency with which the persecutors harassed any heritor with means on account of his religious opinions. Right, a heritor was a landowner who'd have something worth taking. Right, long before the crisis in 1679, Gray's Presbyterianism was definite, making him a marked man. And on his refusal to sign the Highland Bond, the Dragoons rode in, turned out his household, and made his homestead a desolation. For a time, he was a fugitive at the Horn, until after a trial he got relaxation from this hardship, but no relief from persecution. His place was again devastated, his family dispersed, and his wife left in 1681 to subsist on the milk of one cow. In January 1682, he stole home, was spied, taken, and sent into Glasgow and Edinburgh. The council made nothing of him. Untried, he was left languishing in prison for 3 years and a half, until in August 1685, he was included in a batch of prisoners dispatched to the slave marts of Jamaica. There, the old man was unsellable because he was squint-eyed, infirm, done. Only the menace of death and the offer of £15 induced his owner to free him from his custody. He long survived the revolution. The chronicle of the sufferings of Robert Nairn is reverently treasured by his representatives to this day and corroborates Wadrow's tale of woe. Nairn, a thriving shoemaker in Napierston, Bonhill, on the lands of John McAllister, did not relish Episcopal services, absented himself from church, and was hunted about in 1682. His wife, with a babe at her breast, also fled, leaving a maid to care for the other three children. The officers of the Crown arrested the Whig's effects. I take it that means they stole his property. Mother and maid were caught and clapped in ward till caution was forthcoming. Outdoor severities were too hard upon a domestic tradesman, and he contracted a mortal malady. He crept into a neighbor's barn to die. Before the bailiffs arrived to hale him into a prison, Nairn's spirit had fled. The parish incumbent, William McKechnie, Master of Arts, refused the use of the mort cloth and locked the churchyard gate in the face of the burial party. Even these churlish acts were outdone by the sheriff officer, who arrived before the baked meats were eaten, to summon widow and heir for the crime of removing the dead body of a rebellious dissenter. Meanwhile, executions continued apace. On the 2nd of March, 1682, William Hervey was hung at the cross of Lanark. He was accused of rebellion in publishing the Lanark Declaration. In fact, he was apparently a moderate, believing in kingly government according to God's word, and was even willing to say, "God save the king," but that didn't save him. He was still hung. Robert Gray from Northumbria was hung in the Edinburgh Grass Market on the 19th of May for writing a letter in which he gave reasons for disowning the king. In August and December, more Covenanters were hung for offenses such as having been present at Bothwell Bridge or Drumclog, or refusing to say, "God save the king." And Hewison quotes one a guy named Robertson, a pious packman, garrulous and vituperative, was a complacent perfectionist who boasted, "I am a true Christian, truly anti-popish, anti-prelatic, anti-sectarian, anti-schismatic, anti-Erastian, a true Presbyterian, owning the true Protestant religion, now owned and professed by the poor, wrestling, and suffering remnant in Scotland." Town major gave him a sound drubbing with his cane to stop him from speaking. An Alexander Home was tried for having fought at Bewley Bridge, roaming about the borders armed, and he confessed that he attended two conventicles, and on his way home he and his servant had made a harmless commercial visit to Mackerston to buy a bay horse. He was tried on the 21st of December. 8 days later, he swung at the Market Cross of Edinburgh. His last words were, "I am loyal and did ever judge obedience unto lawful authority my duty and the duty of all Christians. Farewell, my dear wife and five children, dear indeed to me, though not so dear as Christ, for whom I now willingly suffer the loss of all things, and yet am no loser. I leave them on the tender mercies of Christ." And with the rope around his neck, he sang, "But as for me, I thine own face in righteousness will see, and with this likeness, when I wake, I satisfied shall be." Okay. I told Dave I was going to get to 1683 today. I'm going to make it. Claverhouse was promoted to colonel of a newly formed regiment of horse in Scotland at Christmas 1682. 1683 saw further attempts at refining the repression. This included a crackdown on rural magistrates who were thought to overlook religious offenses. Stories of persecution and hanging go on throughout 1683 in much the same way. Claverhouse was appointed to the Privy Council in May of 1683. As Hewison says of him, he was a thorough Jacobite, believing that Presbyterianism ill agreed with monarchy, that episcopacy was the best antidote to dissent, and that he had an irresistible call to become the official cleanser of the infectious plague of Presbytery, a high priest of the vindictive order of Caiaphas. Well, it's 10:28, so stop right there in 1683 and see if there are any questions or comments. Bruce, you always have the right of first question.
I have one, but I'll give it some time for others.
Yeah, I think everybody's just waiting for you to ask a question first.
Well, I was just curious with the Has England ever paid reparations?
Well, that's an interesting question, whether they've ever paid reparations. If they haven't, yeah, they might be able to. I don't know if any of you saw this news story about how certain Americans have been claiming reparations for slavery on their income tax returns, and apparently the IRS has like paid out as much as $80,000. I had no idea, you know, I just assumed you did your taxes according to the rules with, you know, sort of the best interpretation you could make and turn them in. I had no idea I could get, you know, something like reparations for slavery, or maybe I could get reparations for my Native American heritage. I'll have to work on this. Mike. That's a good question. Good essay question. I think we could have assigned it to the class as a take home. Yeah. Did you hear that? Did you hear that, Mike? The first answer was the Christians go to heaven and the other ones don't.
You know, when Cargill was giving his dissertation to his followers, the fight.
He might have been able to say that, but at this point they were going to suffer, right? And I mean, they were condemned to death and were dying shortly, so I think he probably kept his words to short. So
what I'm getting at is, it is totally legitimate as a Christian to say that martyrs receive a greater reward.
Yeah, well, I think there's some evidence of that. But again, his point and mine today was that by the same time they could not put their hope in having being martyred, saying I'm going to be a martyr, therefore I'm going to be saved, right? They're not saved because they're martyrs, right? That was his point, and that was my point, right? Whereas in Islam, it's a works righteousness religion, and so they think that they're basically sealing themselves into heaven by being martyrs. So I think there's still a pretty substantial difference, although I think there is a superficial similarity that, you know, from that standpoint. But I think there's really a fundamental difference. Brian?
I was just going to say, unless there was a conviction in the Bible or in Christ that, you know, Cameron seemed to have he felt that that's what Christ had called him to go do. And I don't know how to really explain it other than, you know, if that was Christ's will, that particular person would be martyred, and you're willing to do Christ, if your glory requires my giving my life, I think that's completely different than some selfish motives. If I go blow myself up, I will get all these rewards.
A
Christian doesn't go out and seek martyrdom to receive rewards in heaven. He does the will of Christ as it comes to him. And yes, there are indications that martyrs have a special place in heaven, but I don't think it's something that a Christian gets up in the morning and says, today I feel like going to being a martyr.
Right. No, I agree. That's
a real big difference.
Well, but I mean, if you call yourself a Christian and you do that, I have questions about your salvation.
Well, unless you live in a place where martyrdom is common, like today, you might wake up and say, maybe today I'll be a martyr.
Yes, but you don't get up and say, well, I'm going to go into whatever army it is with my machine gun and take as many as I can before they get me. That's a completely different...
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of, when you look at the Scots that sort of went willingly forward. I mean, a lot of times they were sitting in prison. They knew, they basically, you know, they were going to schedule to be martyred at 3:00, and it was not a... They didn't have any choice left in the matter at that point. Henry, you were going to say something?
One of the big differences is a lot of people go for innocence.
Yeah, well, that too, yeah. So, Mike.
If I were to come from home,
yeah.
Okay, when did I kind of know that I could be killed? In the sense that I was that different, I knew exactly what was going to happen. Sooner or later, I would have gone. Yeah, I've gone. And they willingly went to be martyred.
Yeah, yeah. But like Renick preached, I think for four. He returned in September of 1683, and he was executed in February 1688. I mean, he actually went and ministered for nearly 5 years, 4.5 years. So yeah, I mean, he knew, of course, he could have been martyred the first week. I mean, he knew that was the kind of risk he was taking. But I mean, he didn't go only to be martyred. He went first of all to preach the gospel. And then, you know, but knowing that martyrdom was a likely, you know, was a likely outcome.
I mean, I would liken it to a soldier that gets orders to go to a hot spot, Afghanistan. You know you might be killed, but that's your duty to go do.
Yeah.
If Christ calls you to go to a hot spot, you go to the hot spot. Because anywhere else, it's not going to be as good.
Yeah. And when you're there, you could say, don't you wish we'd enlisted in the Navy? yeah, no, you're exactly. That's a very good analogy. Yeah. Yes.
One observation: one of the real issues with them is that they're willing to give their lives, regardless of whether that was giving their life in one day or giving their lives, you know, one day at a time for the rest of their life. So I think that's something we can, even though we're not physically here in America, we can be thinking, how can we be giving our lives one day at a time?
Yeah. No. So.
See, the anybody watching this on the internet, the World Court model. The six nations voted for the World Court. Remember, so the World Court has been charged against American citizens. I mean, we're not very far off the way. Can you imagine? You win. We still have nukes in the Navy.
Here. Okay, well, let's...